It's Monday, March 25, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. This week is set to become one of the most momentous in the history, the constitutional history, of the United States. That is because this week, on Tuesday and on Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments on two cases dealing with the United States Constitution and the issue of the legalization of same-sex marriage. The two cases are by now well known. The first is a constitutional challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act. The other is a challenge to California's voters when they adopted what is now known as Proposition 8, the constitutional amendment in that state that stipulates that marriage is to be the union of a man and a woman, and that exclusively. The two cases come before the nation's high court simultaneously in oral arguments to be held in 2 days this week. 2 days that will go down in the nation's history as among the most significant in terms of the issues that are at stake. The United States Supreme Court has stood on the threshold of similar questions before. Sometimes it has acted in ways that history has judged to be right. Sometimes history has judged the court to be woefully wrong. But what is looming before the U.S. Supreme Court in this case is the big question of whether or not it will make a sweeping decision that would eventually mandate constitutionally the legalization of same-sex marriage in all 50 states, or whether it will actually rule more narrowly, deciding whether or not the voters of the state of California had the right to stipulate that marriage is exclusively the union of a man and a woman. On the other hand, the challenge to the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, passed in 1996 with overwhelming majorities in both houses of Congress, signed into law by former President Bill Clinton, that challenge comes down to how the United States government at the federal level will define marriage and whether or not states, the individual states, have a right to refuse to recognize same-sex marriages that are fully legal elsewhere. These huge questions now loom before the Supreme Court, and also the court has to have very much in mind its own stature and reputation, its own institutional credibility as well. There's much to be discussed along those lines this week, but perhaps one of the interesting talking points comes in the Washington Post on Sunday from Robert Barnes when he writes, "The court's first full examination of whether the right to marry must be extended to same-sex couples puts on full display the justice's official responsibility as arbiter of the Constitution, as well as its unofficial role as interpreter of the nation's readiness for social change," end quote. That is a stunning statement. And coming in terms of the nation's most influential newspaper in the nation's capital city, it, of course, is a very significant statement. Here, Robert Barnes is making the case that the court has two responsibilities, one official and one unofficial. The official responsibility, he identifies, is the justice's, quote, official responsibility as arbiter of the Constitution, end quote. That in itself is a very interesting statement, one that would not have held in terms of the unanimous judgment of the nation's founders, but one that has been, nonetheless, the political practice of this land ever since the early Supreme Court decision in Marbury v. Madison, by which the Supreme Court ruled that it had the responsibility for constitutional supremacy. And now, of course, that issue comes before the Supreme Court in terms of what is now almost universally accepted, which is that the court has the responsibility to determine what the Constitution does and does not say. But when it comes to the issue of the court's, quote, unofficial role as interpreter of the nation's readiness for social change, end quote, that is profoundly not what the founders of this constitutional republic had in order. But this is exactly what the Supreme Court has taken on in terms of its own understanding of itself, in terms especially of the second half of the 20th century. In case after case, momentous issue after issue, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that it would indeed fulfill the very responsibility extraneous to the Constitution that Robert Barnes says that it now cannot escape. It is, according to his assessment, the unofficial interpreter of the nation's readiness for social change. And on that question, as we will see this week, the Supreme Court justices appear themselves to be quite troubled and quite reflective about what this particular case or set of cases would mean in terms of the credibility of the court, in terms of its responsibility not only related to the Constitution, but in terms of its status as a barometer for the nation's social change. But any way you look at it, the Supreme Court cannot dodge the constitutional questions that are here involved. In a very interesting op-ed piece over the weekend by Supreme Court scholar Michael McConnell, McConnell made the point that the U.S. Supreme Court will set a precedent one way or another, not only in one but in both of these cases, And as we shall see, those precedents are likely to have a far-reaching effect, not only in terms of the federal government and the issue of same-sex marriage, but on the issue of the trajectory of moral and constitutional issues looking far into the future. By the way, in terms of Robert Barnes' article, he goes over the arguments on both sides, that is, those who are urging the Supreme Court to make the kind of sweeping decision it did in 1973 in the case of Roe v. Wade, and those who are warning the court that it must not. Paul D. Clement, who was representing the House of Representatives in defending the Defense of Marriage Act in terms of the Supreme Court arguments, he's made this point, quote, "With an issue as fast-moving and divisive as same-sex marriage, the advantages of the political process are substantial," end quote. Clement is then arguing that the Supreme Court should simply stay out of the politics of the matter and let the political process run its way. However, there are others who are arguing the other way, including those who are the attorneys who will be making the case for the plaintiffs in the challenge to California's Proposition 8. What they are calling for is precisely the kind of sweeping decision that others fear. Anna Fifeld, writing for the Financial Times of London, says that any way the court turns, it's going to have to make a very dramatic decision. She argues that the hearings this week, quote, "will be the apogee of a dramatic month for supporters of same-sex marriage." She goes on to write, "Public attitudes have shifted dramatically in favor of legalization, forcing many politicians to play catch-up and voice support for gay marriage in ways hardly imaginable during the divisive 2012 presidential election campaign." She cites Evan Wolfson, a leading proponent of the legalization of same-sex marriage, who said, quote, "There is irrefutable momentum, and not just growing but broadening, and support for the freedom to marry." He went on to say, "We've worked hard to make our case in the court of public opinion, just as we will in the court of law." Now, Fifeld also reports on recent surveys that indicate that it may be that a majority of Americans now view the legalization of same-sex marriage either as something that should be or at least will be approved. And that comes down also to the question of just how the political process will or will not be allowed to go forward. If the Supreme Court makes the sweeping decision that many are calling for, the political process will simply be nullified, and the court will have ruled in the way that it did in Roe v. Wade. But, as you'll recall, Roe v. Wade did not end the debate over the issue of abortion. In many ways, it exploded it in ways that continue today, with the issue of abortion even more contentious and divisive in American politics than it was in 1973. In terms of the political debate, Chris Cezilla, writing at the Washington Post again, updating an article and an argument that he's made previously, says that regardless of how the high court rules, the political debate is, he says, arguably over. He cites Anna Navarro, a Florida-based Republican strategist, who said, quote, "There's no putting this genie back in the bottle. This is now undeniable. The shift is here. We're not going back," end quote. Cezilla goes on to say, "A look inside the numbers makes the case even more strongly. It's no secret that the issue divides strongly along generational lines, with 80% of those ages 18 to 29 supportive of gay marriage, compared with 44% of those older than 65. But then he goes on to write, "What's remarkable is that the generational divide on the question is stronger than the partisan one." From a Christian worldview perspective, that's very interesting. In other words, the partisan divide is unquestionably significant, but the generational divide appears to be even far more so. Now, when you think about this, we realize that far more than perhaps we recognize, we are a part of a peer generation, and many of the cultural assumptions that we simply find comfortable and even unacknowledged come from our peers. That's true whether we are members of the GI generation, of the baby boomers, the millennials, or now the subsequent generations coming along. Chris Cezilla's point is that these generations, by the way, tend to follow moral trajectories. They tend to move, not in lockstep, but certainly in terms of momentum and in majority in the same direction. That's why he thinks the political debate is over. From a worldview perspective, this reminds us that if we are not careful, we will simply think like those around us think. And perhaps this is an indication that one of the most important markers for the way we would think, just as others think, is generational. Geography and other issues no doubt come into play, but one of the most interesting things we are discovering in this is that that generational divide even trumps family identification, such that what one's parents hold on this issue is seemingly, in terms of influence on a generation, less than how peers think. And if you've been on a local college or university campus of late, you know that on the issue of same-sex marriage, there has been a lightning-speed moral revolution, such that in many college and university contexts, it is simply unthinkable that this is still an issue. Now, with that, of course, is the realization that this generation not only has decided that the issue of same-sex marriage is simply a given, it has also lost any concept of how the natural family would have been formerly privileged and would be defended. That means, in terms of the recovery of a notion of the natural family, we have far more work to do than anything the Supreme Court would understand, or for that matter, can change. You can count on an absolute avalanche of coverage on the issue of same-sex marriage this week, and it's likely to continue for weeks to come, especially in light of the fact that the Supreme Court is expected to hand down its decision on these questions in June. But there are so many interesting aspects that show up in perhaps even some unexpected places. For instance, Leonard Pitts, a rather liberal columnist who writes op-eds carried in syndication across the country, writes that Senator Rob Portman's change of mind on the issue is not something to be congratulated. He writes, "Let there be no cheers for Rob Portman." You'll recall that the senator from Ohio changed his mind just a matter of a little over a week ago on the issue of same-sex marriage, claiming that he did so because he wants his own homosexual son to have the same rights and privileges extended to his other two heterosexual children. Leonard Pitts writes that there should be no cheers for him. He's not writing from the conservative side, arguing that the senator has made the wrong direction. He's arguing that the senator has finally come along for reality, but he laments the fact that it had to do with his own family. Pitts writes of Portman's decision, quote, "It was, make no mistake, an act of parental love and empathy and deserves to be celebrated on that basis. He did the only thing a good father could have done, and yet if Portman's change of mind warms the heart, it also paradoxically illustrates the moral cowardice so often found at the heart of social conservatism," end quote. There's a lot embedded in this article, but the most interesting thing is something that you may have heard right in the heart of that paragraph. He writes concerning Senator Portman's change of mind, quote, "He did the only thing a good father could have done," end quote. In other words, according to Leonard Pitts, the only thing a good parent can do is endorse whatever's the sexual lifestyle of his own children or her own children. It's an amazing statement, but it is very reflective of a general trajectory in the culture coming not only on the issue of sexual morality, but on how parents are to relate to children. Again, I quote, "He did the only thing a good father could have done," end quote. So he wasn't a good father, evidently, in Leonard Pitt's view, until he had this change of mind and made his public declaration. But he still is not to be congratulated for it, even though he has moved in the direction Leonard Pitts would want, because he did it related to his own family. By the way, when it comes to social conservatives, Leonard Pitts doesn't acknowledge that there could be any legitimate concern. This is the kind of liberal arrogance that is found, well, increasingly rarely amongst those who realize that someone is actually going to be reading their columns. But Leonard Pitts writes this article as if no one who would be reading his articles would be concerned about the fact that he's not very thoughtful. He writes this, "Once again, conservatives will stand rebuked by history, be left on the platform by progress, or else split the difference, or do the right thing for the wrong reasons, like Rob Portman," end quote. It's an amazing display of the kind of liberal elitism that certainly is behind the worldview of so many, but most learn how to disguise it a bit better than Leonard Pitts. Again, his statement about the issue of same-sex marriage, he writes, "Change is coming, gathering momentum like an avalanche," quote, "and once again, conservatives will stand rebuked by history." Well, is that always the case? In his view, it evidently is. "They will be left on the platform by progress or else split the difference, and," here he says, pointing again to Senator Portman, "do the right thing for the wrong reasons." We might say they could also, as a greater fear, do the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. Finally, even as the supporters of traditional marriage are getting ready for some kind of march on Washington this week, gay marriage opponents held a final mass protest against a bill that would lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage in France. As the BBC reports, hundreds of thousands of people have gathered in central Paris for a final mass protest against a bill to legalize same-sex marriage and adoption. According to the BBC, demonstrators gathered along a street right up to the Arc de Triomphe. As the report states, quote, "There were scuffles and police fired tear gas as the protest spilled over onto the Champs-Élysées, the avenue which runs past the president's palace." Now, the Senate in France is expected to debate the bill to legalize same-sex marriage next month. It has already been passed by the lower house of parliament. The most interesting thing to acknowledge here is that we're talking about what the BBC reports as hundreds, that is, hundreds of thousands of people who have come out in Paris, of all places, against the legalization of same-sex marriage. Now, when you think about Europe, knowing that it is socially and morally far more liberal than the United States, At least the perception would be, or the expectation, that in France, same-sex marriage would already be legal. But it isn't. And this is an indication that even a nation like France has enough of a Christian conscience, at least, to know that there is something that is wrong about the legalization of same-sex marriage. And even as the BBC reports that opinion polls suggest a majority of French people still support gay marriage, it is also significant that the BBC reports that the numbers of those in France supporting same-sex marriage have fallen in recent months and weeks rather than growing. In other words, once a major public debate has emerged on the issue, well, it turns out the momentum towards the legalization of same-sex marriage has faltered. We can only wonder how that would happen if we were talking in this country about a legislative proposal to legalize same-sex marriage before either house of the United States Congress. That would be a very different political reality, and it would be a very different constitutional question. Furthermore, it would be a very different moral discussion as well. And thus you might wonder, why has that not happened here? Well, it's because the issue of marriage, in terms of American constitutional history, has been something that has been left primarily to the states. That's why, with the exception of the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, which after all was about protecting the state's rights not to acknowledge a same-sex marriage that was done elsewhere, the challenges have been primarily addressed to initiatives that have begun in the states, like California's Proposition 8. Meanwhile, also speaking about France, the headline in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend was, in blow to Hollande, France drops tax on rich. You recall that François Hollande, the socialist president of France, ran on a platform in which his number one point was to tax the rich. He proposed a tax of 75% on incomes of $1 million or more. But now he has had to withdraw this proposal. And this has been an incredible embarrassment for the French president. By the way, his approval ratings have fallen. In March, only 30%. Surveyed by TNS Sofres, a polling company, said they were satisfied with the president, down from 35% the previous month, and indications are that his current status means that his public popularity is plummeting. By the way, what we're talking about here, of course, is the nation of France, a nation that has been notoriously inclined to tax the rich. But there are limits even on the ability of this very liberal European nation to tax its own citizens. By the way, one of the reasons the law failed is because the rich pointed out they can move, with some of the most illustrious and well-known wealthy people in France moving right across the border to Belgium or even to Russia in order to make the point. Well, evidently, at least some in France have heard the point. And the question will be just how survivable this is for the French president, who, by the way, ran on the platform not only of taxing the rich at 75%, but also of legalizing same-sex marriage. According to the polls in France, on that score, he may well win. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.